It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network, Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up later on Central Time, a former CDC expert on abortions weighs in on state efforts to limit access to the procedure.
First, it's the morning after the big game, but the Super Bowl is still dominating conversations today. Seahawks and Patriots fans can agree that it was a crazy, exciting game, but for those of us who aren't fans of either team, or Katy Perry, or football for that matter, the real draw of last night's game was the commercials.
Each year, there's a lot of buzz leading up to the release of these ads, followed by a lot of dissection and analysis of each one afterward. 2015, no exception. There were hits, there were flops. This year, we find ourselves wanting answers to questions, though, like, why was everything so serious? And do I really have to dance at McDonald's to get free food?
Here to break down this year's batch of ads is Derek Rucker, professor of marketing in the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University, where he co-leads the Super Bowl Advertising Review. Derek, welcome back.
Thank you so much. It's great to be back.
Well, let's start with kind of a deep philosophical question here. What is the purpose of the ideal Super Bowl ad?
So at the end of the day, the ideal Super Bowl ad should do something to stimulate sales at some level. That could be that it creates brand awareness, it motivates the consumer to consider your brand, or it actually motivates you to go out and purchase. But at some level, I'm spending $4.5 million for 30 seconds to create some movement.
And this is an era of, you know, that internet thing. There are a lot of ways that people try to target their consumers directly. Does that dilute some of the impact of the Super Bowl ad with all these other micro-targeted ads out there?
It's a great question. In fact, if anything, it's helped the Super Bowl. And you might say, well, why would it help the Super Bowl?
Yeah.
Well, With the Super Bowl, it's our biggest reached vehicle as advertisers. We're talking over 100 million. I think, you know, they were projecting like 113 million watching. And what the Super Bowl, what the social media has done is it's actually found a way to accelerate or strengthen the television platform. So you and I, we buy a spot for $4.5 million. We're going to build stuff around it so we get the most for our money.
Well, watching at home, you know, it can be a subjective thing, whether you're crunching something loud, you miss a line, whether you're just not in the mood for a particular ad. So it's kind of arbitrary the way people at home digest commercials. How do you guys do it at Super Bowl Advertising Review?
Yeah, so first of all, at the Super Bowl Advertising Review, we're not watching the game. We're just watching the commercials. So that was tough this year because it was actually an exciting game for what I'm told. But what we're doing is we're actually asking strategic questions. And so we try not to look at just whether you like or dislike an ad. Certainly the consumer reaction is one component of success, but we look at things like, is there good, strong branding here? Is there something that differentiates this brand from the competition that will help consumers gravitate towards it? So again, we have a strategic lens that say, let's move it from just producing something entertaining to something that's going to build a brand.
Well, let's get to some of the grades. Let's start with one of your A rankings. I think this one topped the rankings at the Advertising Review. A McDonald's ad, it was promoting its new Pay with Lovin' campaign. Here's a little bit of that ad.
You know what, for your payment today, do you have your cell phone with you?
Yeah.
Dial up your mom, tell her you love her.
Excuse me?
Hey, Mom. Just wanted to let you know that I love you.
Te quiero mucho. How about you just tell me how much it is?
That is how much it is.
So I am familiar with McDonald's and the products they have on offer. So why is this ad successful? Why might this motivate me or other consumers to like the brand more and buy stuff?
Yeah, so let's break it down. So there's a few strategic components that this ad does well on. So the first is it's a McDonald's ad. Linkage is very good. They talk about McDonald's throughout. They show McDonald's throughout. So I'm not going to have a mismemory of what it was for. So that's the first thing we look for. We like to see that. Second, they're integrating their effort with a new promotion they have, which is basically, I think it's now until February 14th, McDonald's is going to do, you know, exchange certain kind acts for something from the brand. And so that's what we call, okay, that's a position. That's something that separates you from other brands. So this ad is not just a, let me feel good about McDonald's. It's an ad that has some linkage to it, that has a positioning about it, and these are strategic elements that we like to see.
And it did have that, you know, sort of sentimentality to it or something, and that was in keeping, it seemed like, with a lot of the other ads. They were serious, they were emotional, There were lost puppies. There were little kids telling dads that they love them, and on and on. Why was it so, I don't want to say mawkish, but why was it so serious and emotional this year?
No, and that's a great observation. I think it's true to what we saw. And, you know, I have two working theories. I haven't had time to go track down, you know, all the brand managers and ask what's going on here. But there are two working theories. And so one is, if you just look around the NFL this year, there was a lot of controversy off the field, right? So with domestic violence and so on, that here was a year that your brand might be tempted to be safe. And so emotionality is not always safe. I'm happy to talk about Nationwide. That's one that was emotional and probably a little not too safe. But being sentimental, being thoughtful might be viewed as a safer place. I think that's one possibility. Like, if I'm going to go to the Super Bowl, given the current climate around the NFL, I have to be extra careful as a brand this year. I might shy away from something that might be comedically funny, but might send the wrong message around aggression. So that's one. And then the second thing about being safe in this year's Super Bowl, if you will, like, why else might you do it? Well, or I should say emotional, is that we've seen emotion in the past, and in the past it's often worked well because it was the standout. There were only a few ads like this, and so this could just be people saying, you know, the emotional pitches do a good job winning. There's not too many of them. Let's do that. And the problem is, if we all think about that at the same time, well, now we're undifferentiated.
Well, you mentioned one that I think has the most people talking now, that Nationwide commercial, very serious, trying to draw attention, they said, to the risk of household injury for kids. Let's give a listen.
I'll never learn to fly or travel the world with my best friend. And I won't ever get married. I couldn't grow up because I died from an accident.
So that definitely got people's attention, but a very jarring note. What do you make of that one?
Yeah, and just for your listeners, the thing you don't see, because you're only listening, but it ends with a picture of, like, a bathtub full, and so there's like, what does this mean? You know, what actually happened? Did the kid drown? Mm-hmm. And so here's one where I think here's a brand trying to take a position about things they care about, but it's the wrong message to the audience in the wrong venue. And so I think one of the reasons people were upset about it is not that the brand was trying to do harm, but, you know, if I'm watching this with my 7-year-old daughter, she turns to me and says, "Daddy, what's this ad about?" And it's like, this is not the conversation we want to be having during the Super Bowl.
Right. Is it a little tone deaf in that way that, you know, you have to realize that you're coming out of this commercial back into football and high energy and you know, cheerleaders and all the spectacle?
I think it's a little bit like, what do consumers in this environment want? What's their mindset like? And so it doesn't mean you can't be emotional, because Budweiser was emotional. But you've got to be careful. And when you go negative, this is a kind of a general rule of advertising. If you're going to go negative, you've got to have a payoff that's positive enough to offset that. And I think with the Nationwide, you really just end this on a negative. And that's not something people want during the Super Bowl. Certainly not something you want to discuss with your kids.
Well, Nationwide, its name is trending on Twitter big time, and it's all over the place. So they've got their name out there.
Yeah, so this is, you know, the classic question of, like, so any publicity is good publicity? And the answer is, well,
maybe not.
It's a trade-off. The question is, does the awareness offset the negativity? And so if everyone knows me but they don't like me, I'm in trouble. And a great example of that was GoDaddy, which pulled their originally planned spot because there was so much negative sentiment around it. You know, I think with Nationwide, where they can try and navigate this, is this type of negative outcome is not something historic to their brand. And so I think it's a genuine misstep that they should be able to apologize for, and hopefully consumers will be receptive to that.
In the line, you know, by the same token, you're saying if it's not the kind of conversation you want to have with your kid during the Super Bowl, could that also be applied to, I think it was a Carl's Jr. ad where there's a, you know, she looks like she's naked, a lady walking through a fruit market, and, you know, there's all these clever, you know, fruits that might look like her derriere or her breasts,
yep, yep.
And, you know, but, you know, is that also something that parents are going to want to watch with their kids next to them?
So I think it raises this really interesting observation, which I think, you know, going back decades, people usually thought of the event as a male-oriented, focused event. If you just look at who's watching over time, that has shrunken, where it's basically like, this is a party event, right? This is, I think Super Bowl parties are number two. Find, you know, most parties in a day next to New Year's Eve. What my aha was after reading some of these tweets is like, oh, wow. And it's not just about, you know, both genders. It's about families watching now. And so, sure enough, I think, like, as more families watch, you as a brand have to start thinking about, well, how will everyone react to this?
We're taking a look at the best and worst Super Bowl ads from last night with Northwestern University marketing professor Derek Rucker, and we want to hear from you, too.
What was your favorite commercial from Super Bowl 49? What really set it apart for you from all the other ads? And were there any that you just really, really didn't like? You thought hit a wrong note? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And you can also post your thoughts over on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking Super Bowl ads, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Our guest is Derek Rucker. He's professor of marketing in the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University, where he leads, co-leads the Super Bowl Advertising Review.
And you can join our conversation right now with your picks for the best and the worst ads from last night at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post about it on the Central Time Facebook page.
Well, before we get to our callers, Derek, I want to bring up one that fits my model, the Super Bowl ad, the quirky one that puts a new name into your head. Let's give a listen to the Loctite Glue Super Bowl ad.
And if you make a thing, I break a thing, it's no problem. Loctite will fix it up and put it back together again. Because if it's broken, it's unspoken what you need to get your chew.
All right, so, and this is people dancing around, not models, you know, ordinary people with fanny packs. This is my favorite of the night, Derek. You all gave it a C. I'm not going to say you're wrong, but what did you make of that one?
Yeah, sure, and I think it's fine to, you know, disagree, because you might be evaluating it from a different lens than we are, right? So you can like an ad, and we just ask, okay, well, given the time it had, did it do the most to really explain why this brand does it better than other brands?
Okay.
So we're looking at, okay, yeah, could you have done more in the time you were given to really take this from just a funny spot to something that people will remember that will position your brand? So that's where it's like just not enough messaging in there to elevate it on a strategic point for us.
Let's go to our callers now. We've got Patrick joining us from Wisconsin Rapids. Patrick, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, thanks. What was your favorite?
Well, I thought the most creative was right at the beginning of the game, where the TV service was interrupted and went out, and kind of this heart-stopping moment I felt all across America. People were like, oh, what happened? And I think it really got people's attention to focus on the message, and then it was for Chevy trucks with the new 4G Wi-Fi in them.
And so you weren't annoyed at that. They just grabbed your attention.
Yeah. After a few seconds, I realized what was going on. I was like, oh, that's pretty clever. It got me to look at the TV and really pay attention. So
a lot of people interested in those first few seconds of static, thinking their TV was going out at the worst possible moment. But was that a winner for you, Derek?
Yes, that's an interesting one. So we only count ads that are actually considered Super Bowl buys, which means you're going to appear from kickoff to end of game, because that's where you're paying the big money for the audience. And that was just like the caller, I think, Patrick. I had the same response, like, oh, man, I'm disappointed that this isn't a Super Bowl spot. Because I thought that was a pretty clever attention getter that you didn't see coming. And it really, you know, in terms of attention, did amazingly well. So we didn't critique it through. I think it probably would have done fine with our panel. I'd have to look at it again in terms of how much strategy there was once you revealed who the brand was. But in terms of attention getting spot, that was pretty clever.
Patrick, thanks a lot for the call. We've got Marcus on the line next in Green Bay. Marcus, hi.
Hi. Normally when I watch TV, I mute most of the commercials, but I decided to watch them all for the Super Bowl this year and listen to them. And I got a kick out of a lot of them. The rabbit in the hair with the Mercedes was really cool and clever. And, but anyway, my favorite was the flying pig one, where the young kid goes to the older whoever. And it reminded me of, when I was a kid that age and there was an older person, you know, I'd be ignored or whatever. Didn't count, you know, and other stuff. And, you know, I don't know why I noticed it. But anyway, so the kid goes away, tinkers, uses his mind and stuff, and he comes back, and, he says, okay, you know, and he sort of reverses the roles where all of a sudden, you know, he has a sense of power and he gets what he wants, and the other guy just sits there dumbfounded with the older guy.
Interesting, anyway. Marcus. Thanks a lot. I want to get a response from Derek. So that's the When Pigs Fly commercial, and the kid makes the pig fly, I think is the one he's referring to.
Yeah, that one did pretty well for us. We gave that one a B. Really entertaining spot. You know, one thing that was interesting in hearing that conversation from the callers, I don't think he once mentioned the brand name.
Right.
Right? So that was Doritos. But that's an example of you say, like, what makes you guys, why don't you just look at liking? And this is not to imply the caller thought this way, but it's like, well, some people may love a spot, but not care about the brand at all or remember the brand at all. And that's where a spot that might score well in the hearts of consumers won't score well, so well on our panel.
Well, what about the weird factor? Because some of them are just so out there that you watch because you can't not watch. And one of these was this toenail fungus ad for a product called Jubila. Kind of gross. I don't know. Make the case for that being a Super Bowl ad.
You know, that one is a hard one for me to make. So let me say it this way, actually. So first of all, I can tell you why a brand like that would want to be on the Super Bowl, right? Which is, look, this is a serious problem, and I've got over 100 million people to target and discuss about this. So you can see why they'd want the reach of it. But, boy, that's a hard one from a creative's perspective to say, yeah, that's an exciting one. I want to rewatch it. I want to discuss it. I think by the time it's done, we're done, right? And, you know, something that we always look at, it's this – not tension, but it's the perfection of crafting something that is both strategically sound and then creatively impressive. And that's so hard to get both of those elements right.
All right, just in case you missed it, here's a listen to this toenail fungus commercial from Jubila.
Toenail fungus? Don't hide it. Tackle it with new FDA-approved Jublia. Jublia is a prescription medicine proven to treat toenail fungus. Use Jublia as instructed by your doctor.
Yeah, you could see that one, like, on the, you know, late-night commercial radio or TV or something like that, an infomercial. That was kind of out of place. I wanted to ask about celebrities before we're out of time.
Sure.
Liam Neeson in the computer game Clash of Clans, I think, or the mobile game. And Walter White, Breaking Bad, the character, showing up as a pharmacist in the e-surance ad. I like those. I thought they were funny. Were they effective at selling the brand, do you think?
Great question. So I think this is one where two good choices, too, because I think the Breaking Bad one, people enjoyed seeing the character, and I'd ask them, but what the brand was it for? And then they'd pause for a minute, like, I don't know, but it was so good to see the character. And it's like, okay, so celebrities are attention devices, but we have to make sure that once they get your hook into the ad, you're interested in the product and you get it. And so I love that you brought Liam Neeson, because I thought that was a great example where it's the use of celebrity, but it's so central to what it's about, right? Which is he's got this handheld video game he's playing, he's showing you how it works, and he's part of the story. And so celebrities, you think of them as attention devices. Once you capture attention, where are you going to direct that? And I think the Liam Neeson one did a much better job of that and scored better in our panel for that reason.
All right, well, let's listen to another one of these celebrity spots, this one featuring Jeff Bridges. I guess it pretty much says it all.
I
watched
love
that
this one
and I thought, where is it going? Where is it going? Okay, I don't know. I still don't know where it went. What about that one as a positioner?
Yeah, so this is the one where this is the only one that received a failing grade on our panel this year. And I think it's exactly what you just said. What's the position here? What is this ad about? And so my own take on it is I loved it from a strategist perspective because I say, okay, the first 5 seconds. That's interesting. Let me hear. So you, congratulations, creative is there. You've got my hook. After 10 seconds, I'm like, okay, now my creative part is losing interest, and what's it about? And then by the time the ad finishes, I'm really left with nothing about the brand. And so I think that was a misfire. Like, if we could go redesign that, let's get some positioning in there. Let's get a better linkage to the brand. That was for Squarespace. I suspect most people won't remember that.
That's like a web design thing was the link. It was like this was a website that Squarespace made or something that they tried.
Yeah, and they have links. If you know, Jeff Bridges has, I think, like music on there. He has a site. And so it's not that there wasn't content they could have built around to better explain it. They simply didn't.
So any favorites or unfavorites, Derek, personally or for the panel that we haven't gotten into?
We talked about some of the ones I really liked. I actually liked Coca-Cola as well. So we didn't talk about Coca-Cola, but they were one where they basically built off their old campaign about experiencing happiness and being about happiness, but they took a societally sensitive issue of online or cyberbullying, and did it in a really great way. It's kind of the opposite of Nationwide, where it's like Coca-Cola went emotional, but they went emotional in a way they could solve for but help build their brand.
So they ended positive, unlike the Nationwide one, you're saying.
Exactly. So it's a great example of, can I talk about a sensitive subject like bullying? Like, yeah, if you do it the right way. And Coca-Cola did it the right way.
Is there anything, I don't know, kind of crass about that? You take something that's really serious. We've had deaths around, for instance, school bullying. And it might not be a Coke ad. It might just be a public service announcement. But at the very end, you know, brought to you by Coca-Cola.
Yeah, I think what I would say to that is, as soon as you, like, let's say you and I were deciding to do this ad together, we'd say, is there a risk of choosing to talk about this topic? And the answer to that is an unqualified yes, there is risk. How do you go about it? And I think Coca-Cola did it in a way that made sense. But could they have gotten it wrong? Absolutely.
Well, Derek, it was a lot of fun to listen to these ads and to talk to you about them today. Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure. Always a pleasure.
We've been speaking with Derek Rucker, professor of marketing in the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University, where he co-leads the Super Bowl Advertising Review. Remember, you can keep the conversation about the best and worst of the Super Bowl ads going on the Central Time Facebook page. Listening to Central Time, I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Last month saw the anniversary of the Roe versus Wade decision at the U.S. Supreme Court. The anniversary day also saw a continuing political and legal battle as Republicans in the U.S. House passed a law aimed at making sure federal money couldn't be used to pay for abortions.
That federal action comes as many states have issued restrictions on abortions, including Wisconsin's recent law requiring providers to have admitting rights at hospitals, which is currently not in effect after being struck down in a federal court.
Our next guest says many of those efforts are misguided. In a new book, he traces the impact of legal abortion since that Supreme Court ruling. He says we tend to forget the damage done by illegal abortion and to overlook what he says are the benefits of legalization. Dr. David Grimes is former chief of the Abortion Surveillance Branch at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. He's the author of the book Every Third Woman in America: How Legal Abortion Transformed Our Nation. Dr. Grimes, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
So I wanted to start with a before and after picture. You've written that you're worried that people, including other doctors, have forgotten what things were like before Roe versus Wade. Can you paint us a picture?
I think it's a very clear analogy to what's happening now with measles. An entire generation of Americans has grown up unaware of the danger of measles, and we see people getting complacent about going back to the bad old days. We now are seeing a resurgence of that. Same thing true for abortion. We've had an entire generation of Americans unaware of the dangers of illegal abortion, and we simply cannot go back to those bad old days when women suffered and died in large numbers.
How big of a health impact was this? How much of a stress did this put on the healthcare system?
Well, abortion has been with us as long as pregnancy has been with us, and estimates from the days between, or I should say before Roe v. Wade, were that somewhere between 200,000 and 1.2 million illegal and unsafe abortions took place each year in the United States. And that caused terrible suffering and death. For example, every large municipal hospital in America had an entire ward filled with patients suffering from infectious complications. And in the year that I was born, more than 700 women died this way. And the population of the nation was less than half of that today. So that would be the equivalent of over 1,000 women dying every year from unsafe abortion today.
So now let's look at the after picture. What impact has legalized abortion had since Roe versus Wade?
Well, deaths from illegal abortion disappeared almost overnight. Abortion has become one of the safest procedures in all of medicine. Indeed, for the last several decades, the risk of death from an abortion is less than that from an injection of penicillin.
So I want to turn to the title of your book, Every Third Woman. That's how many women in the United States have had an abortion at some point in their lives?
That's correct. A little known fact, but if current rates prevailed, one out of every three American women will have had one or more abortions by the time she reaches menopause. Since Roe v. Wade, more than 50 million American women and their families have been beneficiaries of safe legal abortion.
And I wanted to talk some more about the benefits for women. That's part of what you look at in your book. What are the benefits outside of health, but the social benefits, as you see it, for women having access to abortions?
Well, Well, safe legal abortion rivals modern contraception, such as the birth control pill, in enabling women to space pregnancies. This allows them to continue to higher education, to join the labor force, and to contribute to American society in many, many important ways other than just bearing children.
And you follow up on that by looking at the impact on families as well.
Right. The legalization of abortion quickly had an impact in preventing shotgun marriages. It prevented or lowered the risk of having single women heading family households. It also led to drops in premature births and neonatal or early newborn deaths. So it had a number of obvious and important health benefits very, very quickly.
You've talked and written, not just in your book, about almost a linguistic war over definitions in the abortion debate, swapping around words like fetus, preborn, things like that. Can you untangle that a little for us?
Right. There's certainly a terminological tangle surrounding abortion. Some of this is due to naivete. Some of it's due to disinformation and misinformation. The misuse is intentional. We hear terms like the unborn child. Well, if you look at any dictionary, children don't live in the uterus. There are many places they can live, but that's not the uterus. The occupant of the uterus is an embryo and then later a fetus. That's not the same as a child. And just like a fetus is not a preborn, I'm not a postborn, and I'm also not a pre-dead person. So we ought to be careful about terms. Words matter, and we should use them wisely.
But regardless of the scientific definitions of the words, a lot of people, based on their moral and ethical system, believe that the embryo or a fetus is the moral equivalent of a human life. So logically, they would object to any form of abortion.
Well, these same people would have us believe that blueprints for a house are the same thing as a complete structure, and burning the blueprints would be essentially equivalent to arson. Most reasonable people say that's simply not the case.
Well, obviously, a lot of people feel that way, though. That's why these state laws, and we'll get into those in a minute, why these state laws are emerging. That's why it's a national issue. A lot of people's philosophical and moral system leads them to that decision. How you want to change that, it sounds like. How do you reach out to them and convince them to think otherwise?
Well, I wouldn't want to. I'm certainly not trying to change other people's thinking, but by the same token, how should or why should they be able to change my thinking and my practice in taking care of my patients? It's a matter of choice, and they should not force their opinions on me and my patients, especially when the health benefits of my course of action are so clear and incontrovertible. I'm not trying to change their opinions, but they're trying to change mine. That's the problem. And they stand between me and my patients, and that violates my ethical principles as a doctor.
Well, I want to get into the state laws that I just mentioned. A lot of different states, including Wisconsin, have had some efforts to get some or all of these that we'll get into. I want to start with the idea of waiting periods, the idea that often a woman seeking abortion has to have one appointment, have a certain amount of time, a cool down period, some call it, and then come down and have the procedure. What do you see is wrong with that?
Well, first of all, it's degrading. Degrading to women, suggesting that they're flighty and capricious and haven't really thought about their course of action. By the time a woman gets to a provider, she's already thought long and hard about her decision. It trivializes women further by suggesting that 24 or 48 hours is going to make a difference. The ultimate goal of these laws, and the anti-abortionists are quite clear on this, is to deter women and make it so expensive and so inconvenient that they simply can't access the services. It also serves to drive women across state lines, increasing the costs and risks to them.
And then another state law we see often is the idea that women have to receive some type of state-mandated counseling, and that usually involves a specific list of things they need to hear before receiving an abortion. What do you make of those?
These are highly offensive, not only to women, but also to us as physicians. It suggests that we physicians are not capable of doing informed consent, as we do for all operations or procedures. And again, more than 50 million times, we doctors have done this quite well. There's actually a survey done of abortion patients by the Picker Institute some years ago in Boston. They followed up several thousand abortion patients to ask them about their care. And the overwhelming consensus was that women felt that the quality and quantity of information they received about abortion was superior. So there's just no evidence that they need more. And the problem with the state-mandated information is it's oftentimes disinformation, not information. That both these crisis pregnancy centers to which women are referred and the internet sources have been shown to be full of propaganda that's unscientific and untrue.
Could you give an example of what you're calling disinformation? What kind of misinformation do you see women receiving under these state mandates?
Common misinformation or disinformation is the allegation that abortion increases the risk of breast cancer, which is a lie, that it leads to mental health problems, which is a lie, which it leads to prematurity, which is another lie. But these things are widely disputed or refuted in the medical literature, yet they're popular among these crisis pregnancy centers, which have a religious theme and not a medical theme as their basis.
While we're on the subject of misinformation, we are, of course, in the age of the Internet. Do you think that is leading to better or worse information in the general public when it comes to abortion?
Substantially worse. And there was just a paper out published in December of last year by Dr. Amy Bryant and colleagues at the University of North Carolina, looking nationwide at Internet sites from these crisis pregnancy centers. And it confirmed what we had suspected, and that is there's gross misinformation and disinformation being dispensed by these sites. As a physician, I can say that I spend a good bit of time in clinic trying to disabuse patients of the fearful and dreadful things they hear or read about on the Internet.
One more common state law, and this is one that's passed here in Wisconsin. It's on hold, struck down by a federal court. Supporters are hoping to get it to the U.S. Supreme Court at some point. The idea that an abortion clinic, an abortion provider, needs to have admitting privileges to a nearby, you know, within a certain radius, hospital in case of emergencies.
This is a particularly pernicious kind of legal restriction. First of all, no one supports this in the medical community. The American Medical Association does not. The American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists does not. The American Academy of Dermatology as well disagrees with this position. It's gratuitous. Secondly, any hospital in the United States which receives federal funds through Medicare or Medicaid must accept emergency patients in transfer for stabilization, regardless of ability to pay. So there are no needs for this. Hospitals will take emergency patients as is by federal law.
So you see this as an effort to restrict, make it harder to have this kind of clinic in place?
Well, what it does, it gives local hospitals veto power and restraint of trade over local clinics.
We're talking to Dr. David Grimes, former chief of the Abortion Surveillance Branch at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and author of the book Every Third Woman, How Legal Abortion Transformed Our Nation.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you agree with what our guest says are the benefits of legal abortion, or are you in favor of more restrictions on abortion providers, maybe even outlawing abortion altogether? Call us at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation with Dr. David Grimes. He's the author of Every Third Woman in America, How Legal Abortion Transformed Our Nation. And he makes a case that making abortion legal has had benefits for American women, and he's worried about state and congressional efforts to create new restrictions.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Would you like to see more restrictions on abortion or see it outlawed again? Or do you make the case and agree with the guest that abortion access has benefits for women, for families? 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to a caller. We've got Laura on the line in Lake Geneva. Laura, hi.
Hi. I was listening to your show, and it really hit home in a lot of ways. About 40 years ago, I was about 17 or 18, and I became pregnant and thought long and hard about aborting the fetus. And I was young, I was scared, and my partner at the time made arrangements for me to meet with a gentleman. Well, it was actually a physician, but it was done in a hotel room. And, of course, I was terrified. And I had a second one about it. 6 months later, I became pregnant again. And this time I met up with it was a group of women that we were taken in a minivan blindfolded to the place where the procedure was done. And again, I was terrified. I was young. I went on birth control after that, but my gosh, it was a scary experience, I'll tell you. And I made out safely, but it was scary.
Laura, thanks a lot for your call. Not unique stories in the age before Roe versus Wade, Dr. Grimes?
Correct. Laura, I appreciate your sharing that difficult story with us. And those kinds of horrific experiences were very common back then. I'm old enough to remember those bad old days, and we must not return to them. That is the alternative for our nation if these laws increase.
Thanks for sharing your experiences, Laura. We've got Jim on the line next in Marinette. Jim, hi.
Hi. I'd just like to, I think arguing that pro-life and pro-choice are the opposite of each other is like saying that apples are the opposite of calculators. They have nothing to do with each other. What you need to do is get, are we pro-abortion or anti-abortion? I think abortion should be legal, but I think we should solve the problem of it, so many people wanting them, like making adoption a much easier choice in the United States, maybe paying for a mother's medical bills, and at the end of the pregnancy, giving her a stipend or something like that to give her child up for adoption, because it seems crazy that adoptions are so expensive in this country that people go to Russia and everywhere else to adopt kids.
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. There's often, the argument, okay, let's set the argument aside and find solutions, Dr. Grimes, that make abortion more rare anyway. Do you think that's a productive way of approaching the problem?
Absolutely. I think Jim's point is very well taken. Abortion is not a problem. The problem is an unintended or abnormal pregnancy, and we should work toward reducing that. But words count, though. He said pro-abortion, anti-abortion. No one is pro-abortion. Just like saying no one is pro-mastectomy. It's not an inherently nice operation, but sometimes a mastectomy is just what a woman needs. We should work to reducing the need for the operation.
Thanks a lot for the call, Jim. David is with us now in Duluth. David, hi.
Hi, doctor. In my home state of Texas, the legislature has enacted a lot of restrictions on the physical facilities that abortion clinics may operate out of. This has caused most of them, as I understand it, to close because they can't afford the changes in the architecture of their buildings. As I understand it, they have to now have very similar facilities as an outpatient surgery clinic. I'd like your comments on this, the necessity of this, what type of problems does this raise for clinics to meet, and what type of problems might it solve?
David, thanks for your call. Dr. Grimes?
Thank you for that very important question. These laws, which are called targeted regulation of abortion providers, or TRAP laws in short, are widely used around the country to try to drive providers out of business by making it simply too expensive to stay in business. First of all, there is no public health need for them. As I mentioned before, the risk of abortion is negligible. The risk of death has been less than 1 in 100,000 for many decades. Having a baby in the United States is 14 times more likely to result in death of the woman, yet we see no attention spent on the safety of childbearing in America. What's happening in Texas is that women in West Texas are being driven across the border now into New Mexico. Women in South Texas are crossing into Mexico to get illegal abortions. This is really a sad state of affairs. There have been studies as to what are predictors of states implementing these trap laws, and it has nothing to do with religiosity, the proportion of Catholics in the state, but the one significant predictor is control of both houses of the legislature and the governor's office by a Republican.
Thanks for the call. We'll go next to Margie in Milwaukee. Margie, hi.
Hi. This hits me emotionally for lots of different reasons. I totally agree with the doctor, and I'm disappointed that it's taken so long for a lot of the medical community to come out and fight against all this craziness that's going on in all these other states where the laws have been changed so that abortions are harder or impossible to get. I was pregnant 40 years ago before marriage, and I fought long and hard, and it was just the year after Roe versus Wade. A girl in my dormitory at college nearly died coming back from an out-of-state abortion, and she was right across the hall from me, and I remember that paramedics coming in to get her and take her to the hospital because of a botched abortion, and they said that she might not ever have children again after that. I got married and had my child, but 17 years later, I went through a divorce, and I had 4 children, 2 of which were under 2 years of age. If all of these laws and changes come forward so it's impossible for women to get abortions, what happens to a woman that is raped and wants to have an abortion? I was petrified I would have been petrified because as a mother, single mother of four kids, I was having enough trouble keeping my own emotions afloat and taking care of my four kids. If I had been raped and had to deal with a unplanned, unwanted pregnancy that I was forced to have the baby, emotionally, I think I would have fallen apart.
Margie, thank you so much for sharing your experiences. We'll get Dr. Grimes in on that in a moment. And we also have Stephen on the line in La Crosse. Stephen, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I've noticed that this show so far today has been mostly pro-abortion. And I guess I'm just kind of calling to voice my opposite opinion that just the thought of how most people today keep trying to argue that the embryo that's inside there is not a child, I think is absolutely wrong. And I do understand that when it comes to rape and when it comes to incest and stuff like that, that's a whole different category, but it's just not really the case. Usually I see so many, you know, teens and women getting abortions just because they think they have better things to do, or their parents are forcing them to do it or something like that. And there actually is a lot of women out there and who have their own stories of how thankful they are that they didn't get the abortion when they see how beautiful.
Stephen, thanks. Almost out of time. Dr. Grimes, a brief response.
Well, let me respond first to Margie. And the question of rape is a very important one. And I think your listeners need to know that the Republican Party has had complete abolition of abortion as a plank in its platform since the 1980s. And at the most recent convention, there was no exception for rape or incest. That is cruel beyond words. Regarding Steve's point of view, we need to respect the individual woman's choice. Choice is important, and we, especially men, should not force our opinions on women.
Dr. Grimes, we'll leave it there. Thanks to Dr. David Grimes, former chief of the Abortion Surveillance Branch at the Centers for Disease Control. His new book is Every Third Woman.
Today, if you didn't know, it's Groundhog Day and six more weeks of winter, apparently, according to Punxsutawney Phil, who saw his shadow in Pennsylvania this morning.
Yeah, I don't know if this is really legit, if this really predicts things, but it has a long heritage. I found this online today. The Groundhog Day legend is based on an ancient Roman Hedgehog Day. Similar deal, except substitute hedgehog for groundhog. You're a hedgehog fan.
Well, hedgehogs are. I hate to say it and be disloyal to the good old North American groundhog, mm-hmm. right? But the hedgehogs, they're adorable.
Right.
And they're surprisingly skilled with meteorology.
Right. Oh, cool. I didn't know that. Well, and closer to home here, Sun Prairie, right, has its own Groundhog Day observance. Apparently this year, Jimmy the groundhog, he's a local predictor, he bit the city's mayor on the ear.
When he was supposed to be whispering the secrets of the seasons, he bit the mirror.
Yeah, I don't know what that says about how much winter is left.
Nothing good, I'm afraid.
Yeah, but you know what? A hedgehog would never have tried to pull a stunt like that.
No, never. Let's go back to the ancient Roman
man's
hedgehog
best friend.
Day.
Yeah.